Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Early this year, a solar storm sent 40 Starlink satellites plunging back to Earth. They had been sent into orbit by SpaceX, that's Elon Musk's rocket ship and satellite internet company. They were expected to burn up in the Earth's atmosphere. It highlights the growing problem of all the junk, an estimated 27,000 pieces of orbiting debris that we as a planet shoot into space, and how we deal with it or not, as the case may be. Somebody who thinks about this has an office in downtown Lexington. You might have spotted his company's name, Rubicon, on an upper level of City Center as you're driving down Main Street. Nate Morris, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Oh, thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
So the Dallas Morning News recently published an op-ed that you had written. It titled, "The Threat of Low Earth Orbit," and we're going to discuss it in just a moment. But first, some context, if we could. Why is a Lexington business owner concerned about space junk?
Well, I'm very proud of the fact that, I'm the founder and CEO of Rubicon, as you mentioned, in downtown Lexington. I'm a ninth-generation Kentuckian, and the first person in my family to become an entrepreneur. And I started Rubicon with the idea that waste needs to be eradicated. Our mission is to end waste, and that's really in waste in all of its forms. That's the garbage that we all see that goes out at the curb at our homes, at the back of business. But it's also wasted time, wasted energy, anything that keeps us from being as productive and reaching our full potential as possible. And as we've been building a company that is in the process of becoming public, it was reported by the Wall Street Journal a few months ago, we've been building and working with some of the largest companies in the world to help them with their waste and recycling needs and to offer a digital challenge to the traditional waste and recycling model that we've all seen for generations. And really trying to level the playing field to allow small business to play, for Kentuckians to play, and to really rethink about what the category of waste actually means. And I think it's a Main Street issue that not a lot of people want to talk about, but has tremendous environmental implications and also implications to your pocketbook. And one of the topics that kind of came on our in front of us was the idea of space waste. And space waste is, I think, one of the biggest threats to America's national security in the long run. We've got more debris in space than ever before. It seems these days that the private sector and governments alike are launching things into the atmosphere very frequently. And because of that, we've got more stuff in space than we've ever had. And this debris that's left over, whether through satellite failure or explosions, as you mentioned, that creates debris that is harmful to other satellites, which can compromise the way that we engage with the national security community, the way that we receive information, the way that we get information through our phones and computers. And so we set at Rubicon to fully live up to this mission to end waste. We've got to go to outer space as well and start figuring out how we're going to deal with that. Now, this is something that, as I've learned, even at the highest levels of the government doesn't really know yet what to do about all this. Mm-hmm. So we said, look, the private sector needs to lead on this. And that's what we're doing as a private business, is to offer help for the security of the United States, but also that we think there's a big opportunity if we can figure out how to solve this problem.
Well, Nate, I know that you're also a senior advisor to the Atlantic Council's Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. So how does all of this align or come together to inspire these concerns about space junk?
Well, I think national security is everyone's issue. And we've taken for granted for many years that we've lived in a very safe environment. I think the world is more dangerous than ever before. And I believe it's the responsibility of companies to disclose how they are helping to aid in the national security of American citizens. And we need to know what our companies are doing, who they're engaging with. Are they engaging with our enemies without our knowledge? So I believe that as Americans, we have to demand of our companies to be transparent about who they're engaging with, because especially the tech companies are going to be the platforms by which we get attacked and we get compromised as a nation.
We may be about to find out about that, huh?
Well, I think certainly there's a lot of talk, obviously, with the current news of today and obviously all the things that are coming out of Russia. But it goes to the heart of the point that national security is all of our interests, all of our business, and we need to start asking tough questions of the products that we're supporting. What are you doing for the security of the average American and the people that are out here working hard and trying to live their life in the safest and best way they can? What are you doing for us to make sure that we're safe?
Well, in the introduction, I mentioned those Elon Musk Starlink satellites, part of a system of satellites that will number 12,000 eventually. And they are to carry broadband internet to parts of the world where internet access has been unreliable or too expensive or completely unavailable or all of those. And in your op-ed, you warn that our internet, communications, cable TV, and GPS all depend on these low-orbit satellites, and they're all at risk. Tell us about that.
Well, again, it goes back to the idea that the more stuff you're putting in the atmosphere, so as particularly the private sector is launching more things into space, and that other governments around the world are now launching into space, we have all this stuff that gets stuck up there. And, you know, this is space debris that's traveling between 17,000 and 25,000 miles per hour. And so even a tiny screw or a tiny fragment of metal can completely destroy a satellite if it gets hit. And so this is something that we believe at Rubicon has to be tackled. And we're trying to put our money where our mouth is. And we've created a prize called the Clear Constellation Prize, where we're actually engaging some of the greatest rocket scientists from around the country, from Yale and Harvard, also engaging students to win a six-figure prize to figure out who can come up with the best method to tackle this at scale and to begin these conversations, I think, with the public and private sector to say, what are we going to do about all this space junk?
Well, you begin your op-ed with an example of what can happen. You write about something that happened late last year. It involved the Russian military blowing up one of its old satellites with an anti-satellite missile. And you note that this action was part test, part demonstration. What was Russia demonstrating?
Well, I think they're demonstrating to us that they're going to launch at will. And we used to have space all to ourselves. And I think as a lot of the American presidents have said that, you know, we've got to win space to make sure that we're secure on the ground. And I think that's the big idea. But I don't think there's a natural order of things the way that used to occur even years ago. So I think the Russians are trying to test our limits to see what we're going to do and how we're going to respond. And I think that's a very dangerous place for us to be if we don't respond correctly and we're not aggressive about defending outer space and certainly demanding higher standards related to space waste.
You mentioned this earlier, but I just want to drill down into it just a little bit. You issued this challenge to American colleges, the Project Clear Constellation, to work with you. Tell us more about that. What are you asking of colleges and universities?
Well, today there's only a handful of people, I believe, in the world that really understand space waste. So it's a very esoteric category. Not a lot of people have information about this. So we're in this phase of discovery. We're in this phase of ideas, and we want to assemble the best young thinkers that have a vision for how we can get this stuff down, how we can deal with it. And we put a test, and obviously, as I mentioned, we're putting a very large prize as an opportunity for whoever comes up with the best idea, which is going to be judged by former members of Congress, former NASA administrators, former astronauts, the rocket scientists from Yale and Harvard, as I mentioned. So some of the best minds who understand space are going to be the judge of this competition. But I'm really proud to say that, you know, we have a competition group from the University of Kentucky that I'm betting on, I think, you know, could have maybe the best solution out of all the American colleges.
That's great to hear. And so let's say somebody in our audience hears this and they want to rise to the occasion. What should they do?
Well, if you go to clearconstellation.com and you also can access the competition through the Rubicon website, rubicon.com, and there's a space waste prompt that allows you to get all the information that you need that you can share with any higher ed organization that is eligible, which is a four-year institution, and share with them the details and how they can get involved in the competition. But I'm really betting on Kentucky to play big in this and hopefully I believe Kentucky will come out on top. I'm hopeful that I think some of the best ideas can come from places like Kentucky, not just California, New York, like we see in the media so much.
All right, that's Nate Morris, Chairman and CEO of the waste and recycling software company Rubicon. Thank you so much, Nate.
Thank you for having me.
I'm a space cowboy, bet you were ready for that. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Full disclosure here, if you've heard our closing credits, you know that we love dogs around here at Eastern Standard. I'm talking about Neil's rescued black lab, Ella. You listening, Ella? Some of the finest, most honest, most loyal, the friendliest, often funniest individuals I've ever known just happen to be dogs. The thing is, not all of Kentucky shares this point of view. Kentucky has for years ranked at the bottom when it comes to animal protection, and that presents a challenge to Todd Blevins. Todd is Kentucky State Director of the Humane Society of the United States, and he's joining us now. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Todd.
Hey, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
And so let's look at that ranking that I just mentioned. For a long time, we were dead last in the country when it came to animal protection, according to the Animal Legal Defense Fund. That's improved a bit in recent years. What's happened to bring about that change?
Well, you're exactly right, Tom. We were in the basement, 50th out of 50, for a dozen years or so. And of course, when you become so low on the totem pole for a long time, people start to pay attention. And so a couple of things happened to help us climb the rankings. One was we finally made animal sexual abuse or bestiality illegal in the state of Kentucky, made it a felony crime. And that helped bumped us up to 47. And then folks may or may not know this, we were actually the only state in the country for a long time that actually prohibited vets from reporting suspected animal abuse. And so a couple of years ago, we were able to enact a new law that repealed that, I think it's fair to say, outdated provision. And that moved us up to 45th. So still got a long way to go. We're still obviously in the bottom tier, but I like to think things are looking up.
That prohibition on veterinarians reporting animal abuse, has animal protection been applied, or was it before the law was passed, applied too broadly beyond pets to include farm animals? Was that the reason for that?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement, Tom. What I would say is that I think there was some concern in the agriculture community that allowing a vet to, or let me say that a vet might misinterpret traditional farming practices. I don't want to go into the validity of that, but I do want to draw a clear distinction between, everyday issues that affect dogs and cats and the companion animals that we all love and consider members of our family, as you mentioned in the intro, and farm animals, which of course, we have a strong agriculture tradition and interest in this state, and we don't want to do anything that that would, negatively infringe on that while also respecting animal cruelty laws. So yeah, I think it's fair to say that, there's been a dichotomy in those interests. And in fact, that vet immunity law, vet reporting law, made such a distinction regarding companion animal reporting abuse and farm animals. I think we have, the way I look at it, Tom, is that folks, by and large, consider their dogs, their cats, even their horses as members of their family. I mean, you mentioned Ella in the introduction. Mm-hmm. You mentioned cats. I mean, we all, I think, by and large, consider those animals to be cherished members of our family and deserving of humane treatment.
Well, in the case of farm animals, I guess farm animals can be abused. Do you still, despite that new law, do you still kind of keep an eye on that?
We do. Anytime there's an animal who is subjected to cruelty, we want to make sure that animal is spoken for and that perpetrator is held to account. Regardless of whether it's a dog or a horse or a lizard or what have you, our mantra is to advocate for all animals and to make sure that none are forgotten.
Now, Todd, I know that you advocate for something called a cost of care law. Tell us about this.
Yeah, we do. So, you know, Tom, this has become a really major focal point in the animal welfare community in Kentucky for especially the past 2 or 3 years. So there have been cases all around the state that demonstrate the need for a cost of care law. And I'll just briefly explain what it is. So a cost of care law would allow a seizing agency, when an agency has to go and seize animals for suspected animal abuse, it would allow them to petition a court so that the owner of those animals or that animal is required to pay for the cost of caring for those animals until the criminal case against the owner is resolved, until it goes to trial. So this is important, obviously, for a couple of reasons. And I think the most important way to put it is that if you look at the status quo, you know, animals are unlike other forms of evidence. You can't just, put a dog in an evidence locker. And so they require constant feeding, they require veterinary care, they require boarding and so on, and that costs money. Well, obviously somebody has to pay those funds, and at the moment, it's you and me, it's taxpayers, and it's the agencies that seize those animals and the counties that those agencies are under. So what a cost of care law would do, as I said, would be to shift the onus of paying for those costs from the agency to the owner, who I think it's fair to say would be paying for the cost of caring for their animals anyway. You know, if you're an animal lover, I think there's something to obviously like about this bill. It helps, it obviously helps animals receive the care they need, but it also helps expedite, where they're going to wind up. Maybe, the cost of care hearing is set to take place shortly after the seizure happens. And one of the things that's determined at that hearing is the ultimate disposition of the animal. And so, you know, if you're an animal lover, there's something to like about it. If you're somebody who's concerned about personal responsibility, there's definitely something to like about that. So, you know, we always say that animal issues are not red versus blue, Democrat versus liberal, Democrat versus Republican issues. So we think this is a pretty widespread supported bill.
There was a recently filed set of federal indictments that allege a conspiracy involving organized cockfighting at several venues in eastern Kentucky, in Clay, Laurel, and Pike counties. What about this pitting animals against each other for entertainment or for wagering?
Yeah, it's an unfortunate fact, Tom, that this continues to go on in the great state that we call home. I always say that cockfighting is the black eye of Kentucky. It continues to be that way. We're arguably the nation's biggest hotbed for cockfighting. And that is largely due to our ineffective laws that are designed to address that. So the case that you mentioned is actually a federal case, and 17 individuals were indicted on federal charges ranging from bribing a law enforcement official to sponsoring a cockfighting exhibition. If you look at the state level, we are very weak on the laws that are designed to address these animal fighting contests. So for instance, Kentucky is one of only 11 states where it is perfectly legal to own roosters for the purposes of fighting. It's an obvious loophole in the law that prevents law enforcement from being able to do the job that they're set out to do, which is to protect animals. And so we're actively working to try and improve those state cockfighting laws. And I want to commend all the federal agencies that were involved in the case that you mentioned, because, you know, it helps bring a spotlight on just how far we have to go on animal fighting, particularly cockfighting here in the state. And if I may, Tom, one other thing I'll mention about this is that if you look at dog fighting, our laws are pretty robust. For instance, owning a dog for the purposes of fighting is a felony level crime. And so what we would urge legislators to do would just be to make it so that those laws match regardless of the animal that's fighting.
I don't mean to make light of this, but it would seem that we need a stronger chicken lobby.
I think that's a fair way to put it, Tom.
Todd, just a couple minutes left here, and I wanted to ask you, the pandemic has played out in our humane shelters as well as in our homes and businesses, and I'm just wondering, what have you been hearing from the shelters across the state about their experience during this time?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting, Tom. As we've all experienced the past couple of years, we've seen waves of COVID, and you know, thankfully things seem to be on the wane by and large now. But the animal sheltering community has not been spared from those. So I think it's probably the easiest way to express it is just to briefly talk about it in stages. So in the first stages of the pandemic, you know, there were a lot of folks who unfortunately had to surrender their animals due to job loss or maybe some housing insecurity or another factor in their own lives. But on the same token, the public stepped up and fostered and adopted animals at you know, just really, really heartening rates. That has since declined and you know, continues to be mainly flat in the subsequent stages of the pandemic. But something else that happened early on is that spay neuter and other elective surgeries had to be postponed. And that's, you know, we needed PPE for people at the time. So there's still certainly a backlog of that. And what that's resulted in is that animals that are in shelters now have been there for longer. And another factor that's contributing to that is we've seen in other sectors of the economy is that there is just simply a staffing shortage at our shelters and our other humane societies. And so, you know, I know our shelters and humane societies out there are doing the best that they can, and I want to tip my hat to them for the care that they provide to animals every day. And I know there's probably some listeners out there who are wondering if there's anything they can do to help. What I would say is the most important thing you can do is to step up and adopt or particularly foster from your local shelter. They certainly could use all the help they can get, and you might just find your new best furry friend. So we would certainly encourage folks to do that. And it's kitten season, you know, as you and I are talking, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a cat fan, then now's certainly a great time to adopt or foster a cat.
All right, that's Todd Blevins, Kentucky State Director of the Humane Society of the United States. And I see Ella over there is giving you a paws up. So thanks a lot, Todd.
All right. Happy she approves.
Yes, she does. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
Coming up after the break, an inductee into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame.
It's pretty awesome to be listed among such people.
And technology that takes a Lexington artist's works to an entirely new level.
Augmented reality actually uses your device, your phone, through way of a browser or a mobile application to then transform the real world into an augmented landscape.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power and energy usage information to co-op members. Co-ops offer an online energy assessment to help evaluate energy usage. More information is available at your local co-op's virtual energy assessment link.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Recognition is on the horizon for Kentuckians who have that gift for writing in ways that make us think about the world around us or unlock our imaginations. And here with details about this upcoming event is the host of our series on Kentucky literature, Tom Eblin.
The Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame was created a decade ago to recognize outstanding writers whose careers have contributed to the culture and character of the Commonwealth. Since 2013, 50 writers and poets of the past and present have been inducted to the Hall of Fame at the Lexington's Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. 5 new inductees will be added to the Hall of Fame this year. The ceremony is at 7 p.m. on March 24th at the Kentucky Theater. It is free and open to the public. This year's inductees include two deceased writers. One is the acclaimed poet Robert Hazel, who as a University of Kentucky creative writing professor was a teacher and mentor to five Hall of Fame writers. The other is Ted Poston, a Hopkinsville native who was the first black journalist to become a star reporter on a major New York newspaper. Poston won some of journalism's biggest awards for his coverage of civil rights stories in the 1940s. Three other inductees are living Kentucky writers whose work has had a big impact. Loyal Jones is a scholar of Appalachia, founder of the Appalachian Center at Berea College. James C. Clotter has been Kentucky's official state historian since 1980. A retired history professor at Georgetown College, Clotter has written many award-winning books about Kentucky history. And last but certainly not least is George Ella Lyon, a prolific writer of both adults and young readers. She's an award-winning poet, novelist, and picture book author, and a musician, too. George Ella is here with us today to talk about her writing career and her newest book of poetry, Back to the Light, which was published last year by the University Press of Kentucky. George Ella, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, first of all, congratulations on your selection to the Hall of Fame.
Well, thank you. It's pretty awesome to be listed among such people.
Well, now, you were born and raised in Harlan. What led you to become a writer?
Well, I grew up in a house full of books and music and with storytelling people. And my father read poetry out loud sometime. And when I heard it, I just felt, well, that's it. I want some of that. And I was a shy child, and writing was a way I could express things that I couldn't say because I knew about poems. I knew that possibility and how much they thrilled me. I turned to writing, although I didn't think when I was in high school that I would be a poet, though I was writing poetry all the time. My focus was more on songwriting. It was the folk frenzy in the 60s, and I had my dreams of joining them up in Greenwich Village.
Yeah, so you went to Center College instead, I think.
I did, yes. And I found wonderful, wonderful, wonderful teachers and friends there, especially Roberta White, mm-hmm. who was my poetry teacher and mentor and friend ever since.
Well, what was the big turning point in your career, do you think?
Whoa. As a poet, I finally got a break. I'd been sending out manuscripts for 11 years, and finally I got a chapbook accepted. And then suddenly people see you as a writer, although obviously you were a writer before that, or this would never have happened. Mm-hmm. But that was a big break. But even before that, I was invited by Goni Norman to work on the Appalachian Poetry Project, which put me in touch with all these poets in a five-state area. And so I found wonderful poet friends. And that community was magnified when Goni insisted I should go to the Appalachian Writers Workshop at Heinemann. And then I became a part of this far-flung family that's still going and growing, and which I've been a part of ever since.
Mm-hmm. Well, so many Kentuckians know you from your children's picture books, and that's been a really a big part of your career, isn't it?
Yes, and that was another turning point when I got a note from editor Richard Jackson with an anthology that I had some poems in. And he had seen a letter I had written about my name, and he asked if I ever wrote for children. And if I did, please send him something, and if not, please think about it. And that was a miracle for sure, I knew. And so I began trying to do that. And there is nothing like having somebody who wants to see your work, who sees in you something, and then wants to nurture that. So that very much changed my life. And we worked together from 1984 until his death in 2019.
Now, one thing you haven't been able to do since the pandemic is make school visits, because I know that was a really big part of your effort. And were you eager to get back to that?
I am. I don't know. I mean, I've been doing some Zoom visits all along.
Mm-hmm.
This summer I'm going to do the first in-person visits at summer reading programs. So I'll be in libraries. And then I imagine next fall, if all goes well, I'll be doing some things in person.
Well, now, about how many books have you written? I've tried to count them up a couple of times. I keep missing.
There's a little over 50.
Wow.
And then I've edited some, edited and co-edited some books as well. Well, see, once I had books for children and could work in school, I was no longer teaching part-time and no longer carrying home papers to grade. And so that gave me, that was really a patron. The picture books were really a patron for my writing, you know, for my other writing, as well as the picture books, which I totally love.
Well, which books are you most proud of?
Oh, gosh. Certainly Back to the Light is one of them. It's not exactly a picture book, but a collection of poems for young readers that came out in 2020 called Voices of Justice, poems about people working for a better world. That really seems useful work to me.
Mm-hmm.
And With a Hammer for My Heart, which is a novel for adults, reprinted by University Press of Kentucky. I think that book stands after its original publication in 1997, and I still miss the people in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a bit about your new collection, Back to the Light. Now, this was kind of traces your life, you know, not only your life as a writer, but your life as a person. Tell us a little about this.
It's been a long time coming, and it's had other titles and other shapes. But among the subjects in the book is early experience I had of sexual abuse by a neighbor boy, much older than I. And I didn't know how to handle that. But finally, I saw a way that the book could move from that darkness to light through the things that have helped and healed me. And so, you know, among those are my husband and my children, teachers, friends, the people I've mentioned, other writers and musicians, and from Mary Travers to Virginia Woolf, and writing itself, and singing and dreaming. All of those things are in this book. And so it moves from a very constricted place to a place of being part of it all in the final poem, which is called World Tree.
Mm-hmm. What prompted you to want to explore such personal things with the public and your readers?
I think there comes a time where, for the soul in some way, you need to set those things down. And I'm a writer. And I know that this is such a common experience and so often hidden, so often shameful to the person in whom there should be no shame.
Right. Right.
So, you know, to the extent that we each do what we do, not only for ourselves, but for other people to whom it might mean something, you know, I offer that. I know how reading other writers has and continues to transform me by illuminating parts of my own experience and making me feel less alone. So my hope is that this book can do that for some readers.
Well, in the months since it's been out, have you gotten some good feedback from readers?
I have, yes. People I didn't know wrote to me and thanked me, and a couple said, that's my story too, and you know, so that's a wonderful feeling to know that. And it's really true that in your most particular experience, you're the most universal in a way, because you think it's so strange, but you find out when you express it that you're not alone.
Right.
And
yeah.
So because of the pandemic, I haven't done as many readings as I would have ordinarily, but I have done some of those on Zoom too. And the questions people ask let you know that it touched them.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you. That was Georgella Lyon, author of the poetry collection Back to the Light and one of the newest inductees into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame. Thanks for being with us today.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, I'm Tom Eblin for Eastern Standard.
I Was Here, a multimedia project by Lexington artist Marjorie Guyon, involves imagery that you don't often find in America's visual history. If you've been in downtown Lexington, you may have spotted these images installed at key historic spots, beginning at Cheapside, which was once the largest auction site of enslaved black people west of the Allegheny Mountains. The project, launched in 2016, has been awarded all sorts of grants and honors, and now it's getting a technological boost. With us to talk about it are Marjorie Guyon, Barry Burton, writer and poet for the project, and Michael Baer, owner of Fusion Corp and augmented reality consultant for the I Was Here project. All three online with us. Welcome to all of you, and let's begin with you, Marjorie. Briefly, if you could, give us the backstory on how this project came about.
Well, it was November 8th, 2016, and I had spent most of the night on the phone with my daughter talking about America. And the very next day, the daughter of another mother came to my studio to talk about America. And they were saying, how can we shift the spirit of the country? And I'm an exhibition artist, and I've done a lot of commissions. And I think that the project was commissioned by these two daughters of America. I was in my studio. I looked out the window and I had a vision of an African mother and child. And they moved from window to window like points of light. And I started the project with Ashley, who had come to talk with me about the country. She brought her little boy up to the studio, and the project began with a mother and child. And very quickly, we realized that it really had to include the human family, mother, father, sister, brother. So through a series of wonderful accidents, I met Patrick Mitchell, who is a photographer and actor and director. And he and I auditioned people and found our core who would represent this family of America.
He's not online with us at the moment, but I do have a clip from your video of photographer Patrick Mitchell. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Patrick Mitchell. I'm the photographer with I Was Here. And when I was approached for the project with the idea that ancestral spirit images would be surrounding the courthouse on Cheapside, where people were bought and sold, it was phenomenal. And I just knew it was going to be a healing to souls who were bought and sold, who lived through that trauma, and who know about it today.
So, Marjorie, what do these images ask of us?
Well, this idea to create a set of ancestor spirit portraits that were emblematic of a holy, dignified, powerful, and beautiful people. They ask of America for us to re-see each other in that sense.
And where are these installations located?
Well, in Lexington, they're downtown in the old courthouse and surrounding the old courthouse and at other locations throughout the downtown.
Okay, I'm going to bring Barry Burton online now. Barry, welcome to Eastern Standard. And if you would, tell us what attracted you to this project.
Well, thank you. Well, just to be involved in a project like I Was Here give you a certain sense of meaning to your life. And I started out as a model and ended up being even more for the I Was Here project, and it gives me a platform for my voice to be heard and to voice my opinion on some of the things that are wrong in America today.
And you have written the narrative and poetry about this project, is that correct?
That is correct. I wrote two pieces, Make a Wish on Me, America, and Where Do I Begin? How do I find my way home?
And I know that the phrase E Pluribus Unum is very important to you when you think about this project.
Yes, E Pluribus Unum, because that is a phrase that is on just about every coin dollar bill that was ever printed in America. And I'm not really sure how many people even realize what that means or that that is America's motto. So for me to be able to express myself about that in America and to bring it to the forefront and to make America understand that from one comes many is what the forefathers meant by that, and that we must really literally understand that and try to achieve that objective and goal in America for America to be complete and one country as it was designed to be.
Do you have the sense that it's maybe more important today, right now, to be talking about that than it has been in a long, long time?
Absolutely, because America is more diverse. It has even more personalities and more people. And for America to really be successful and continue to thrive, we must include everyone, and we must assure that what America was built on in its founding fathers, and that all men are created equal, and that we must include every nationality, every person, so that we all have the equal liberties that America allows for each and every individual person to have. And without that individuality, and for everyone in America to be able to access the things and the privileges of America as a whole, we must, without a doubt, bring this to the forefront.
And what does it mean to you personally, Barry, to see and to hear your art as writer and poet involved in such a work?
Well, you have to know my history to really understand what that means to me. A child of 12 coming up in a really low end of towns, fighting for every little scrap that he ever had to one day have his voice heard, broadcasted, and written, recorded, so that one day maybe the whole world would hear it and even repeat what he has been said. It is so overwhelming to me sometimes that, like, I am in a position without the platform, all the, I'm really can't even find the words that I'm trying to use just to explain how much it really involved me and means to me to be heard as a poet and an artist, and I was here.
Well, I think you explained it very eloquently, frankly, and you bring up the technology involved, so let's turn to Michael Baer. Michael, you bring that digital technology to the I Was Here project. First, what is it? What is augmented reality?
Thanks, Tom. So most people are familiar with the augmented reality by way of virtual reality, which is wearing a headset and being transformed into a different environment. Augmented reality actually uses your device, your phone, through way of a browser or a mobile application, to then transform the real world into an augmented landscape.
And so how do you apply it to I Was Here?
That's really what's incredibly exciting about being a part of this project, is that our goal is to take these ancestor spirits and have them appear and have them be visible and be able to have this dialogue that's certainly necessary. And what augmented reality allows us to do is transform that landscape, whether it's the site of a building or a wound site in America's history, and be able to put the I Was Here project there. We have no limitations to where we can do it and what we can do with that technology. And it's just incredibly impactful to be able to bring the I Was Here project to these sites through this technology.
Now, I know there's a second technology that's being used, and frankly, I wasn't familiar with it, but I've already started playing with it, and that's Soundscape. How is that used?
So what Marjorie has been able to do is bring in amazing, talented individuals into this project, one of which being Dr. Michael Priestley, a classically trained opera singer, and it's just amazing to be able to hear his voice dictate some of the imagery and accompany some of Barry's words. It just really highlights all of your senses, so visually, emotionally, and being able to hear the spoken word and to hear the soundscape and the music that accompanies it really invokes all of your senses to be able to really feel this project.
When do you expect that all of these experiences will be available to us all?
Everything is currently live in the App Store. The I Was Here Project app is live and able to be downloaded. And all you have to do is go downtown and you will be directed to different locations and different sites. The actual tour for the I Was Here Project in augmented reality starts inside the Visit Lex building. There's a portrait of a blue horse that so many of us are so familiar with inside the newly renovated courthouse. And if you just simply open the application and point the phone to that blue horse, you will start the experience and be directed to all of the other sites surrounding the courthouse.
Wow, it's pretty incredible. Back to you, Barry Burton. Question for you, after hearing what Michael just detailed for us, what do you hope results from this project?
Okay, Tom, that's a very interesting question. What I hope that results from this project is to bring about true diversity and acceptance of all people in America so that we will learn to look at each other as not as Black or white or Hispanic or Japanese, but as people of one nation that we have all said that we are Americans, okay, regardless of our creed or color, of our background, where we were raised, how we was raised, and to accept each other as one as it was intended to be, so that when you see me on the street or I see you on the street, fear or distrust doesn't immediately jump into my mind because of the shade of your skin or where you originated from or what your past history may be. Because in America, we cannot afford that, because if we do not heal this wound, especially the one slavery left behind, which is the main one that causes more ripples in the fabric of America than any other wound that has been left behind. And if we don't learn to see each other as people that have, each and every one of us, contributed to the whole of America regardless, and that we all should be entitled to participate and share in everything that America has to offer equally. This is what I hope will change with the I Was Here Project.
So, Marjorie, you've watched this project grow and develop over these years. Are you pleased with what has become of it, and is there further development on the horizon?
Well, it has been really one of the greatest honors of my life to have been involved in this. And it's like rocket fuel, this project. And if anybody was to ask for a quick explanation of what it is that enslavement created a wound in our fundamental concept of citizenship in America. And what this project hopes to do is to heal that wound, or as Barry says, a vaccine against this illness. It's been incredible and just such an honor to be part of it. And yes, there are many, many developments on the horizon. We've been invited to several places in the nation. There's just so much going on with it. We would need like another whole show to tell you. But the project has a life of its own.
Well, come back to another show when you have an update, and we'll certainly talk about it. That's Marjorie Guillaume, one of the artists on the I Was Here Project. Barry Burton, its writer and poet, and Michael Baer, owner of Fusion Corp and an augmented reality consultant on the project. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Others who have supported the I Was Here Project include Nikki Finney, Ashley Grigsby, Cindy Deese, Marshall Fields, and Daniel Ware. A follow-up on our hour-long visit last summer with Lexington sports marketing guru Jim Host. At one point, we touched on his position on giving college athletes a green light to benefit from their name, image, and likeness, NIL.
Long overdue. The fact that it's a multi-billion dollar business, it's long overdue to allow these kids to be able to make money off of their name, image, and licensing.
Kentucky college athletes now have more support for this. Governor Andy Beshear signed an executive order about it last June, but legislators believed more was needed to support Kentucky's young athletes. Democrat Senator Morgan McGarvey was at a recent ceremony where the governor signed Senate Bill 6 into law.
And then, of course, when the executive order was issued, we knew that we needed to put this in law so everybody knows that student athletes will have the rights to their own name, image, and likeness. That these student athletes who work so hard at their sport, who can't have another job when they're in college, have the ability to control their name, image, and likeness, have the ability to earn some extra money.
The new law follows a U.S. Supreme Court ruling last June that essentially allowed college athletes to make money from endorsements or social media. It requires schools to offer financial literacy courses to help athletes better understand their finances. The bill sailed through both chambers of the legislature and had the support of Cats coach John Calipari. Next week on Eastern Standard, a tease for you. Spring and then soon summer. And with the warmer weather, the great outdoors. We'll hear about the reopening of the Glady Visitor Center in the Red River Gorge.
And it's a great facility and a great historic site, the grounds around this facility, that visitors can come to learn about the natural history of the area, the history of the people that lived here many, many years ago. They can get information about where to go hiking and camping and rock climbing, all those things you mentioned. And they can now purchase some items that Find is going to have set up there. They can get maps, all that kind of stuff. So it's a great place to go and kind of get yourself oriented to the gorge, but also to learn and experience a lot of what makes the Red River Gorge so special.
And joining our roster of content partners, Aaron Michael of the online news site Lex City. He talks with an amazed Paul Hooper of Lexington Parks and Recreation.
We have over 100 parks, which, if I'm being totally honest, I had no idea was on that scale until I started working for parks. And I've grown up here and knew of so many of them, but truly there's so many parks.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org and on the WEKU app, NPR One, and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.